I don't think. It's like, all right, now we got into office, and now we're just going to have the security state beefed up because screw those civil libertarians, you know? It's not that. It's, I mean, he is a constitutional law professor, and these are things he believes. Civil liberties and privacy are things he believes in deeply.
We'll heal this nation, repair this world, make this time different than all the rest. Yes, we can. Let's go work.
When then-Senator Barack Obama needed a speechwriter to capture the soaring spirit of his 2004 convention speech and launch him to the presidency, he tapped 24-year-old Jon Favreau. The wunderkind political messenger whom Obama calls his mind reader became one of the president's most valued confidants, and from 2005 to 2013, the chief architect of his most famous speeches.
Reaffirm that fundamental truth that out of many we are one, that while we breathe, we hope.
Favs, as he's known to the president, has been listed as one of Time's 100 most influential people in the world, and GQ's 50 most powerful people in Washington. He currently co-hosts the podcast Keepin' It 1600 and writes a political column for The Ringer, and he was a speaker at last weekend's Politicon, the Comic-Con of politics. Reason TV sat down with Favreau to discuss Trump's approach to messaging, why he now supports Hillary after attacking her in 2008, how the Libertarian Party can appeal to voters, and whether Obama's presidency has lived up to the lofty promises and inspiring rhetoric that Favreau crafted.
So, since you're an expert in political messaging, I thought we'd start with the current election.
Sure.
Because there's a lot of rhetoric
flying around. Hard to avoid.
Who do you think is a better communicator, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton?
I think Hillary is. The reason I think Trump is such a poor communicator is he's not disciplined enough to carry a message that could be effective against Hillary Clinton.
So if you were forced to be his speechwriter, let's say,
right,
and he got on message, how would you reshape his communications to make him more broadly appealing?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think I would, I mean, the central message that could work for him, right, is that he represents change and Hillary doesn't. And he would have to talk about, you know, bringing a fresh perspective to Washington and someone who was a business leader. Like, he could have a much toned down version of what he's doing now and be effective. I just don't think he'll ever, I don't think he has the capacity to go there.
Right. But representing change against Hillary, that sounds familiar.
That's what we did, yeah. Way back when.
Are you supporting Hillary in this election?
I am, yes, I am.
So you're also, you know, very good at attacking Hillary, which we saw in 08. What do you see as her biggest liabilities this time around? And if you were to go after her this election cycle, how would you approach that?
It's funny. And I think in 2008, we campaigned against her as someone who was too cautious and sort of had been in Washington for a long time and didn't really represent change and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, you do that on a campaign, and you sort of get in your own bubble and you start to really dislike the other side and you think all these horrible things about them. And then I worked with, you know, I got to see her in action in the White House, and I realized that a lot of the caricatures we painted of her didn't hold up to reality. And so I think that she is, you know, I feel great about my support for Hillary Clinton. I think that she's gonna carry on the Obama legacy in a big way.
You know, one of the frequent criticisms that she leveled against Obama in 08 was, you know, the idea of the 3 a.m. call, right? She's
right.
More experienced. Who do you want picking up the phone at 3 a.m.? Didn't work last time. Do you think she can pull that off this time?
Yeah, I think so. I think anyone can pull that off against Trump because it's temperament more than it is experience. I think that experience is probably a little bit overrated. He does not look in temperament like someone who should be, you know, who should be sitting in the Oval Office with his hand on the button, his finger on the button. He just doesn't, he doesn't come off like that. He doesn't come off like that to Democrats. He doesn't come off like that to independents. He doesn't come off like that to a lot of Republicans. They had the right idea trying to get him on a prompter doing prepared speeches. But, you know, the prepared speech on a prompter he did after Orlando was completely insane.
What is it like to kind of respond to a national tragedy like that or a terrorist attack?
Yeah.
You know, as a speechwriter?
When you're in a responsibility of governing, you have to take time to learn all the facts before you start making pronouncements. So the first statement the president made about Orlando, he didn't say, he didn't mention ISIS. Well, it's because even though news reports had said the guy pledged allegiance to ISIS, the FBI still hadn't confirmed that. And they also knew, they find out later, that in addition to ISIS, he
Hezbollah.
Yeah, he talked about Hezbollah, which is warring with ISIS, and the Zarnoff brothers, who were responsible for the Boston Marathon bombing. So you need to get a full accounting of the facts before you speak, and that's not always emotionally satisfying for people who just want all the answers immediately.
And he recently gave a speech in which he explicitly addressed Trump's attack on him that he doesn't use the term radical
yes,
Islam.
He did.
Why did you kind of avoid that term, or did you consciously avoid
that?
You know,
it's funny. I remember there are speeches that he gave in the campaign in 2008 where I think we used a version of the term radical Islam. This was him getting to the White House, and the best minds in foreign policy and national security said this phrase hurts our efforts on the ground more than it helps them, because we have Arab allies that have skin in the game, that have troops on the ground trying to fight ISIS with us, and they're telling us, if this looks like a war between the West and Islam, it's going to hurt our efforts, and it's going to hurt our efforts to get Arab allies on board in fighting this terrorist threat. And so you say, okay, well, if all I have to do to help that is just not use this term, sure. And I think it was as simple as that when you're in the room thinking about it. And I don't know that anyone was like, well, if you don't say it, though, you're going to get all this shit from everyone on the right that you don't know what the threat is.
There's a lot of criticism of Trump for stoking these kind of group identity politics, specifically against, you know, Mexicans and Muslims. But you could say that, you know, the expansion of the drone program has led to more hatred of America, the lack of closing of Guantanamo, than that type of rhetoric. Do you think that that's a valid argument?
Yeah, when there's civilian casualties somewhere, that's not going to engender a better view of America. I think it's constantly a balance between going after a lot of these terrorists and also taking great care to, as any president has done in any war forever, long before drones, to limit civilian casualties wherever you can.
Have you been following the Libertarian Party at all?
A little bit. I followed the convention, which sounded pretty exciting. And of course, it was interesting to me because Bill Weld used to be my governor from Massachusetts, and he was a very beloved governor of Massachusetts.
What do you think of their messaging?
I think the opportunity is there for them because Trump is so intensely disliked. Hillary doesn't have great favorability ratings either. So I think there's an opportunity for them, and then they have to just decide, what is their message? What do they want people to hear? Because various parts of the libertarian message appeal to various parts of the electorate. I think when you get to things like, oh, we don't want we don't want the government involved in licenses, right? Like driver's licenses. I don't think that's going to find a big reception in the general electorate. But I think there's parts of the message that people would, you know, probably be drawn to.
Let's talk about your time with President Obama.
Sure.
Were there instances where you really disagreed with a policy or an approach that you had to write about?
No, it's funny. It's the most common question I get. And I don't know if it was just because I was in the bubble and a complete Obama Kool-Aid drinker. Maybe that was it. But the substance of all the policies, I was with him.
But so then, as a candidate, do you think that he overpromised?
No, I never. I don't because I think the role of a leader is to hold up our ideals as a country and the ideals that we've had for 200 plus years and say, that's our North Star, that's what we need to get to. And we might not get there in my presidency, we might not get there in the next presidency, but if we can move towards that goal and make some progress inch by inch, then we'll have succeeded in our time.
But isn't there a difference between having, you know, that North Star and that kind of inspiring approach and things like, you know, I'm going to close Guantanamo in my first year, I'm going to rein in the Bush surveillance programs,
yeah.
This is going to be the most transparent administration in history.
Yeah.
Do you think that he overpromised on that?
No, look, Guantanamo is a great example. He said he was going to close Guantanamo. He tried. Congress wouldn't let him. He doesn't have the votes.
He could have expended more political capital on that, right? His first year was mainly devoted to the ACA.
And I think I think if you asked him, was it more important to devote your time to the financial crisis and devote your political capital to passing the Recovery Act and the auto bailout and all this other and the financial bailout and all this kind of stuff versus Guantanamo, he would say, okay, this is a tough decision, but I'd rather expend political capital on the economy. And I also think that there's the reality of Congress, the Congress you have, and this Congress has decided not to agree with him on anything, especially the Republicans, no matter how much political capital you expend. I don't think it was an issue. I don't think Guantanamo was an issue of him expending more capital or less capital. I think it's an issue that the Republicans have decided that they're going to dig in, that they have the votes to stop him, and that's it.
But at the same time, like the ACA, that passed without a single Republican vote. You know, there was massive opposition to that. There are Republicans who support closing Guantanamo, many more than healthcare. So why do you think
I think he probably couldn't get enough Democrats on board there too. I don't know the exact votes on that, but I know that every day the president has woken up and wanted to close Guantanamo. He probably does to this day.
And what about the things that were kind of squarely in his domain, like surveillance programs? Yeah. He was going to curtail Bush.
I think on national security, it becomes very difficult to balance civil liberties and privacy with security. I think that is a constant battle that every president has to engage in every single day. And I think sometimes you make good decisions and sometimes you could have made better decisions.
Do you think that he should have made better decisions in that area?
I didn't get all the intel briefings, so I don't see all the threats that are facing us. But knowing those guys, I don't think they're made because it's like, all right, now we got into office and now we're just going to have the security state beefed up. Because screw those civil libertarians, you know? It's not that. He is a constitutional law professor, and these are things he believes, civil liberties and privacy are things he believes in deeply, but he also has this responsibility as commander-in-chief to keep us safe.
You know, that's the argument that George W. Bush made,
right?
Like, the president knows things, you don't know. Obama saw that, he's a constitutional law professor. He said, you know, there are certain principles that we don't break, the Fourth Amendment, we respect people's right to privacy, and then he expanded the programs, and we do know that PRISM and these other surveillance programs have never foiled a terrorist plot. That was kind of the bedrock of his campaign, and you had a big role in shaping that. So do you still think that he did the right thing?
Look, I think that he has been trying to make reforms over the last 8 years, and I think you need more, you know, judicial oversight on all of this stuff. And I think that's one way to do it. But at some point, you know, someone has to be watching the watchers, right? But I think you do need watchers. I think you do because I think these and I think that's it. There are a lot of plots that have been foiled, and so I think that whoever the next president is, continuing to make sure that there are safeguards in place that if a Donald Trump became president, he doesn't have the executive authority to suddenly create a police surveillance state that has no checks on it whatsoever. I think that's very important.
So you wouldn't want Donald Trump to have a kill list,
right?
But Obama, he's
no. Listen, look, I think that we need safeguards in place, and I think that the judiciary is one place to do that. I think judiciary is probably the only place to do that because I don't think you can open everything up to the public, because you can't have on national security all the time full transparency. Yeah.
But also, you know, on transparency, that was another bedrock campaign principle, right? Being the most transparent administration. And during his administration, he's prosecuted more whistleblowers than any other previous administration. The number of classified documents has exploded. Where do you think he went off the rails in that respect?
Only thing I would say is, I'm only saying this because my friends who worked in the national security decided to say it. I don't know enough to comment on it as much, but overclassification is a huge problem. Too many things are classified just because. And I think the president has recognized that problem as well. So I think that's something they need to do. The whistleblower thing, I have to say, when you sign up and you decide that you're going to be part of the federal government, especially if you get a security clearance, they tell you, if you leak information, it is a severe penalty and very, very illegal. And if you don't want to, and if you feel like your conscience is going to stop you, then don't sign up and don't get your security clearance and go find another job. Those people have to be prosecuted because it's part of the law. And so this whole thing, so far, journalists haven't been prosecuted about this, right? The people who were, the administration has gone after the people who have broken the law by leaking highly sensitive national security information.
But they were tapping journalists' phones, and I mean, there, you know, there was like Eric Holder subpoenaed records from journalists, and I mean,
right,
you know,
because,
you can't deny that he has been more aggressive than any other president.
Once
right?
you get, well, there's just been more leaks.
There's more leaks.
That's why, you know, like I'm for sure the president did not walk in and say, I got to clamp down on all these whistleblowers. It's just the cases come to the Justice Department because someone broke the law and there was a leak in sensitive classified information, and we have to have an investigation. And part of the investigation is, they told this journalist, right? So then that's when records are subpoenaed and all that kind of stuff.
You know, I think it is fair that you say that there's this law, you break the law, you should be prosecuted. But at the same time, you know, they're sworn to uphold the Constitution as well. And you have somebody like Thomas Drake, who tried, you know, numerous times going up the chain, wasn't taken seriously, and that's when he went to the press. Same thing, you know, Edward Snowden, he claims that he went up the chain several times.
Yeah.
So do you think that there's any role for civil disobedience when you are convinced that the Constitution is being violated, which has now been affirmed by federal courts,
right,
and nobody's doing anything about it?
Look, I think that's a tough question. I think I guess I would answer it, I don't know. I mean, I do think there's a role for civil disobedience, of course. And I think there's a role for whistleblowers in our society, of course. But I do think that there are also, you know, like I said, there's laws in the book, and there is a role for civil disobedience. And beyond that, like, I don't know enough about every single case to be spouting off left and right. But the point is well taken.
But you think he's generally, on balance, treated
that
issue fairly?
I do. Yeah.
Another thing that you've talked about, the reason that you really liked working with Obama is because he seemed like a more authentic, kind of honest politician. You point out in Dreams from My Father, he wrote about his drug use and his struggles as a young man. Another way to view that is that there are still people whose lives are being ruined, particularly young black men who are the same age as he was when he was using drugs. He got into power. He did nothing to change the war on drugs. That's still happening today. So why do you view that as a good thing that he admitted to that? You know, you can make the argument that that's not authentic.
I think he has done. I mean, I think that he reduced the disparity between crack cocaine and powder cocaine sentencing. I think he's been working on recidivism issues, and you know, first president to go to a federal prison to talk about incarceration. And I think that the attorney general has. I mean, the prosecutions of people with marijuana has gone down, and sort of the Justice Department hasn't really gone after that. So I do think you can say on. In terms of, you know, locking up people and stuff like that, that there's been some progress.
Although on marijuana, I mean, that was a big, another campaign promise. He said that he was not going to use DOJ resources to go after states that have legalized it. And then he spent twice as much as Bush doing raids of medical marijuana facilities, raided many more.
Yeah.
So how do you reconcile that?
I mean, Colorado has a thriving business right now that the DOJ has not touched. That's you know, so
right.
I think.
But that's just like that's the last, you know, 2 years, right? I'm talking about the first 6 years.
Well,
that
you got. I mean, like I said, you become president, and you've got a whole. First of all, he can't be bossing around the DOJ all the time, because they're independent, and so I think, you know, they sort of came to that. They came to that over 6 years, and we're making progress.
Do you think that there's anything else that you'd like to see him do to rein in the war on drugs, rein in surveillance?
You know, I think there's, like I said, I'm not experts in those topics, so I should not spout off about all the different policies. But what I know for sure is there's a lot more that the next president can do. And, you know, I don't know if he can do it in his last couple months to make sure that, you know, we are not putting tons of people in prison for their whole lives for very small, nonviolent offenses. And I also think there's a lot to be done still on making sure that we can protect this country and still protect people's civil liberties and their privacy. I absolutely think there's more to be done on both those issues.
All right, well, thank you so much for
joining
me. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
For Reason TV, I'm Justin Monticello.